This is Seattle's Morning News. Let's get an update on the crow killings that have been happening in Mount Lake Terrace. Pat Lowe is a commander with the Mount Lake Terrace Police Department. When did this first come to your attention, just to give people the background here?
Well, right in early 2021, starting in January and February, we started receiving calls about some dead crows just throughout the Mount Lake Terrace community. So probably early February.
Okay. And to be clear, were these crows being shot with bullets or pellets or BBs or what?
When we first started receiving the reports, it was just dead crows, and we weren't sure how they were being killed.
But now I saw you had video of this this red truck with the driver apparently killing a crow. Is this the person that we're talking about?
Yes, that's correct.
So you know who it is. You have not filed charges yet, though?
Yeah, we know who he is, and we have not filed charges because we're still, you know, it's still an ongoing investigation, and we still have a little bit of evidence to process. Mm-hmm. So we're also working pretty closely with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and looking at angles on their ideas on what they have as well. So still ongoing.
Okay, well, now what's to invest? I know there's a crow hunting season. I know there are a lot of people who hate the crows because they go after crops and they eat duck eggs and all the rest of that stuff. But I don't believe that under any circumstances you can go around shooting birds in a residential neighborhood, right?
Yeah, that's correct. There is a crow season, and this incident didn't happen during any crow season. There's also the act of depredation where, you know, if a crows are going after crops or so on and so forth, but none of this really applies to Mount Lake Terrace. It's pretty obvious that this guy just appears not to like crows, and he's going around and shooting many, many of them throughout the community.
So have you talked to him?
Our lead investigator, once we determined who he was, we got some pretty good tips based on the video, and people got his license plate after they saw this particular truck in the area during these crow killings. We ended up trying to contact our suspect and had several conversations with him. However, during these conversations, he kept being vague and putting off dates and times that he originally agreed to meet. So he was kind of playing coy with us and didn't really want us to look at his truck.
I see. So did you ever get to look at the truck?
We did. However, one of the interesting facts of this case is during these conversations, when he said his truck was in his garage, we learned later that he actually already had sold his truck and removed some of the identifying features from his truck and traded it in for a new vehicle at a particular car lot nearby.
Well, that's an interesting development. Have you located the original truck?
We did. So we learned the car lot that purchased the truck from him, where that was, and we went out there. Fortunately, the dealership still owned that truck, mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. they gave us consent to search it. And during that search, we found evidence of various pellets, 22 shell casings, and some other things that would lead us to believe that this person definitely is someone who was shooting crows. Also, he had removed a couple of the identifying features, such as the canopy, some mud flaps, and some other things off of the vehicle before he traded it in. And the evidence clearly states that he removed those, to try to avoid detection. So
I see. So that's interesting. By selling the truck, he made it a lot easier for you to search it, didn't he?
He did. He did. He made it much easier. Yes.
Interesting. So, and you mentioned there were 22 caliber shell casings. That's a little disturbing because that can hurt somebody.
It is. So, you know, one of the things we're still trying to determine, is still under investigation, is, what type of firearm he's using. And that's what's pretty scary because if, in fact, he is using a 22 caliber in a neighborhood, and the video is out there, a lot of people have probably seen it. You can see that there's houses and cars driving by, yeah, and people walking around. And that's deadly to the community members. And we got to get this guy to stop doing that, which he, at least in our neighborhood, the crow killings have definitely stopped since this started hitting the media. So
I see. So and that's probably not a coincidence that the stopping of the crow killings coincided with your investigation of this guy. So crow's pretty small target. I realize 22 caliber is a pretty small bullet, but I mean, it's one thing if you're shooting a crow on the ground. It's quite another if you're, like, shooting at them in trees. So what kind of crow, where was he targeting these crows?
So he's targeting them all over. And I guess I want to reiterate that we're not saying that he was using a 22 caliber. Uh-huh. I think it's likely it could be a high caliber pellet type weapon or 22. We're not really committing to what he's using. But mm-hmm. as far as the accuracy and the size of these crows, I've seen some videos where he's shot them from when they're standing on the ground. I've seen videos of he's shot them when they're standing on a power line from some distance. So he has some ability to have some good marksmanship to be able to shoot these crows pretty accurately.
Really?
I believe that he has some sort of marksmanship skill that is probably a little above average.
So it sounds like we can expect an announcement of the identity pretty soon then.
When he gets officially charged, which he will be probably within the near future, then his name will probably be available through public disclosure. But once again, we're still working with the Fish and Wildlife and to come to a really, the most appropriate charges for this guy. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we just want him to stop, because not only do we want these crows to, not be killed anymore, but we don't want anyone to get hurt. And that's a huge concern. So I want to get a resolution to this as soon as possible.
Right. And by the way, just to make sure that we're covering all bases here, if somebody has a real problem with crows, either because they're attacking crops or, trying to peck out their eyes or you just don't like them, what's the legal way to handle something like that?
Well, you're going to have to contact your local animal control. And it's really hard with the crow, right? Because they're difficult to capture.
Well, they're smart.
They're very smart. And in the city limits, there's really not a lot you can do.
Okay. But what we do know for sure is that you can't just shoot them.
100% for sure. You can't just shoot them off of a power line in the city of Motley Terrace in the middle of the daytime. That's definitely illegal. Idea.
Okay. Commander Pat Lowe, the Motley Terrace Police Department. Pat, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
By the way, I realize there is a crow season, but that does not apply to residential neighborhoods.
What's funny is I just had a conversation with one of my neighbors about this, because he's in a long-standing fight with his neighbor to the backyard of him. They share a fence, and that neighbor likes to feed the crows and squirrels. He hates the squirrels and crows because it attracts rats for the food that they don't eat. And he was like, yeah, you can't shoot the rats. You can't shoot the squirrels. They've been calling cops on each other for, I love the neighborhood gossip, but that was new to me. I didn't know you couldn't even use a BB gun to kill a rat.
No. It's because there's children around.
I know. But if you're a sharp shooter.
Yeah. Yeah, he missed at a rifle with a telescope. I mean, to shoot it off a power line?
Yeah.
That's
ill-advised.
Because if you're wrong, the lights go out.
Yeah.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington. An evergreen.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, which is his quick look at the stories behind the names of local places and things. And this week, it's the Mountain Loop Highway, which has been a popular recreation area since the 1930s. And now the Forest Service is about to make some big improvements. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, Mountain Loop Highway is the name for a series of roads in Snohomish County that follow the South Fork and North Fork of the Stillaguamish River and part of the Sauk River. It all goes through the Mount Baker-Snoqualmie National Forest. And the Forest Service just announced a new initiative to address some long-term needs for improving recreation areas along the highway and making it more accessible. Now, that name Mountain Loop Highway, it sounds to me like something from the 1950s, and that is when it became prominent. But the earliest reference using that name was actually 1931. And the southern portion of the road goes east from Lake Stevens through places like Granite Falls, Robe, Silverton, Verlot. And no, it's not pronounced Verlo, and up to the Big Four ice caves. And the route follows much of an old railroad that was first completed in 1893. It went from Everett all the way to the gold and silver mining ghost town of Monte Cristo, which in pictures from the 1940s looks like something out of Scooby-Doo. Now, the mining was pretty much done by 1920, and so the railroad shut down in 1933. And then the highway came about from the efforts of the Seattle and Everett Chambers of Commerce, lobbying for recreation and mining interests. And it was dedicated in October 1942. Now, currently, east of Big Four, the road is still closed for the season. It's probably snowing up there right now. And Matt Phelps of Snohomish County told me it'll probably open up around the end of the month. And when it does, you can continue over Barlow Pass and down into Darrington, and then come west on State Route 530 all the way to Arlington. That's the loop part of the drive. And most of the route is paved, but there's a 13-mile stretch beyond Barlow Pass that's not, but it is passable by most cars. The whole route's about 104 miles. And now the Mountain Loop's a very popular place, and it's getting a little worn down. Parking can be tough at places like the very popular Lake 22 trailhead. Mm-hmm. And so the big news this week is that the National Forest Foundation, that's the nonprofit fundraising partner of the Forest Service, they've chosen the Mountain Loop Highway for their Treasured Landscapes program. Now, the Forest Service has identified about $14 million worth of improvements, and the National Forest Foundation is aiming to raise about $2.5 million of that and to leverage a lot more private and public support and volunteer horsepower, too. Now, it's a four-year project at the minimum, but it will address some big long-term stuff. But the people will start seeing changes later this year, including a new bridge, reopening a bridge across the river at Big Four for the hiking trail there, new and improved restrooms in several places, and improvements to many trails. And really, that's just the start. There's talk about expanding parking areas and just making that area more durable for its continued use. It's only going to grow in usage, probably. The Forest Service told me the designation also makes the mountain loop more competitive for other federal funding sources. And the National Forest Foundation is counting on partners and volunteers to donate money, time, and other resources. And we'll have a link with more information all about that at My Northwest.
Hiked like 22 years ago. And Mount Monte Cristo is still was there when we visited. I hope it's still there. It's not in good shape.
Yeah, there's an old road that goes up that you can only hike up and down. There are a few buildings left, and there's some old signs and stuff, but it's nothing like the bustling mining community it was back in the 1890s. I mean, it's sort of... it's crazy. It's like something literally out of an Old West movie.
It is. All of Felix's features at MyNorthWest.com. Thanks, Felix. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks, Dave.
I was surprised that you know Yogi and Boo Boo.
What are you talking about? I know Moose and Squirrel, Yogi and
Boo Boo.
I mean, how young do you think I am, Dave?
The age of my daughter.
Well, I like to say at the library, yeah. I still had to look up index cards to find where a book was. I still used a floppy disk, MS-DOS, right? I'm an elder millennial. Yeah,
yes.
I'm an elder millennial. I remember when computers were just black with green lettering.
I know Yogi and Boo Boo, too, and all those good cartoons. And,
there you go, see?
You know, they're great.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know, Yogi. Hey,
anyway. You're the best grandpa, aren't you? Your granddaughters must love
right.
you.
We've all earned a Friday, and by our count, this is the 59th Friday of the Morning News from Home era, and ahead this hour, Hannah Scott's going to lay out that unsettling report out of the University of Washington on the number of uncounted COVID deaths around the world. We'll talk with G. Scott today about sports, specifically track, and whether or not Seahawk DK Metcalf is Olympic sprinter material. And in this morning's commentary, bamboo-seeking super cams. First, politics. We called up Face the Nation host John Dickerson because I wanted to know what Senator Lindsey Graham means when he says Republicans can't move forward without Donald Trump.
Well, I mean, he means what John Boehner means when he says a leader without followers is just a guy taking a walk. The majority view in the Republican Party is driven by President Trump, both in specific with what President Trump says, but also in the market that he created with creating an appetite or playing on an appetite in voters for a certain brand of politics. And at the moment, that's not designed around, but two centralizing ideas in that are that the election was stolen and that the insurrection was not that big a deal. The reason that's of the moment is Liz Cheney believes the opposite view on that, and it's the reason she's likely to be bounced from Republican leadership in the House.
And on that, if she and, of course, Mitt Romney's also made noises about being unhappy with the direction the party is taking, why don't they just declare themselves to be independents until the party regains its sanity?
Well, they may very well do that, because one of the challenges here, and the reason this is more than just an interesting intramural fight, is what does the party stand for? Does the party stand for a set of ideas, free market, freedom, low regulations, low tax, or does it believe basically in whatever Donald Trump believes at the moment? There are a number of tenets of the Republican Party that have been longstanding for multiple generations about morality, about character, about deficit spending, about trade, about national security, all of which Donald Trump didn't believe in them. And he got the party to support his new view. Was that because they had a reappraisal of those elements of public life, or was it because they were just affectionate towards President Trump and his political power? What does a party design itself around? And your argument for them becoming independents is that these are members who say, we believe in a set of principles. Donald Trump is antithetical to those. So where's their home in a party that is arranging itself around Donald Trump?
Okay, I think character is pretty much down the tubes at this point. But don't most Americans determine their politics by looking at their lives, whether they're prospering or not, and whether the party that they voted for is delivering for them? I mean, a lot of what drove, I think, Trump's support was the fact that you had a group of people who had prospered in the past with, say, a high school education, but could no longer do that. And then, of course, the pandemic just made everything 100% worse. I mean, when it doesn't it have to come down to eventually, how am I doing?
It does and it doesn't. I mean, yes, it does. But then you have lots and lots of voters who vote against their economic self-interest at both ends of the income spectrum. So you have wealthy college-educated voters voting for Democrats who are promising to raise their taxes in one form or another. And then you have voters at the lower end of the income scale who vote for policies that comparatively won't help them as much as the other party, but they're voting for cultural issues. Mm-hmm. They're voting, and this touches on what you're saying, they're voting for a general sense of disappointment, anger, fear, resentment at the way in which American life has changed since, I mean, you can go back to the 1960s with the rise of a different kind of America than the one they were promised. And that has economic effects, but it also has cultural effects. And so you often see people voting with strong emotional cultural feelings about the direction of America or the other party that take over their feelings about their own economic situation. And then finally, you've got to look at who's participating in what portion of the process. The primary process, particularly in the Republican Party, has an incredible effect and power on the politics of that party. So you can have people with a general view out in the country, but the people Republican lawmakers have to care about are the ones participating in their primaries, and they have a much different view than, say, the general popular view in the country.
CBS's John Dickerson hosting Face the Nation this Sunday. New research from the University of Washington finds that the true number of COVID deaths is much higher than reported, and the pandemic and long-term care situation in Washington. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott, who takes a look at some of the changes that are needed.
Researchers at the UW's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation say the true number of total global deaths from the pandemic is 6.9 million, double what we've seen reported.
It just shows how challenging it has been during the pandemic to accurately track the deaths and actually transmission of COVID. And by focusing in on the total COVID death rate, I think we bring to light just how much greater the impact of COVID has been already and may be in the future.
IHME's Dr. Christopher Murray.
How do we actually figure this out? We use all of those observations on observed mortality. We figure out what mortality should have been. And then the difference between them is excess mortality. Now, excess mortality is we are using as an approximation of the total COVID death rate.
In fact, Murray says
there's essentially six things going on that drive excess mortality. The most important is the total COVID death rate. But then there is the potential for increased mortality due to deferred care. There is, you know, for example, immunization rates for children are down. There is the tendency for increased mortality because of increased drug use and alcohol and depression, for which there's evidence in some countries. There is very strong evidence that excess mortality is an underestimate of total COVID because of several factors. Injury deaths around the world seem to be down about 5%. And there has been, because of behavioral change, marked reductions in flu deaths and RSV, respiratory syncytial virus deaths, and in some countries, measles deaths, all of which combined would actually tend to mean that our estimates based on excess mortality of the total COVID death rate are undercounts.
As far as deferred care for things like heart attacks and diabetes driving these numbers?
So to date, although we expect to see deferred care effects maybe in 2021 for some cancers, we can't find compelling evidence that that is a large effect. And so we think, if anything, the estimates that we have now of the total COVID death rate are undercounts, because we do know that flu and RSV deaths are down quite appreciably, for example, in the U.S., very markedly down.
The Russian Federation had the largest undercount based on their analysis. The analysis found total U.S. deaths nearly doubled from 574,000 to 905,000. Another area getting a deep look is long-term care facilities in our state as they've dealt with the pandemic.
We experienced a disproportionate number of deaths in long-term care facilities But by far, you know, percentage-wise, thankfully, I think a lot of our long-term care facilities did a tremendous job. But unfortunately, more than 2,600 people in nursing homes, including residents and staff, died from COVID-19. And that's 49% of all the COVID deaths in the state. So,
Kathleen McCall, Director of Advocacy for AARP of Washington, says there are a complex set of issues that led to that.
You know, just the model itself of having multiple people living in one facility, also having staff that was traveling from one facility to the other, or multiple facilities, because in order to make a living wage, you know, they had to maintain multiple jobs.
And,
you know, early days of the COVID pandemic, we did not know that this was airborne. And it wasn't until, you know, several crucial weeks later did, you know, a lot of long-term care facilities and Department of Health and everything make a decision to have, you know, personal protective equipment, including, you know, the N95 mask and, you know, the importance of social distancing.
And the real challenge.
But what we are seeing is that there still is challenges around infection control and having adequate levels of the personal protective equipment, including gowns and masks.
McCall and AARP lobbied for change in this past legislative session and got it in the form of House Bill 1218.
Which is really looking at exactly those very issues and making sure that the systems are in place through the government and through the organizations that represent these institutions and the facilities themselves, that there's a better flow of information around what they need and what they need to have available to the residents and family members associated and staff in these facilities.
Among the new requirements, access to phones.
We had received numerous stories from AARP members saying that, you know, they were trying to contact mom or dad in one of these facilities and they didn't have a phone, or they tried to contact the staff and their call was not returned for 2 weeks. And so, you know, we really said, you know, we wanted a piece of legislation that, you know, provides a minimum standard for these facilities in terms of responsiveness to family members who are concerned about their loved ones, doctors who want to talk to, you know, their patients who are residents of these facilities. It also includes having an adequate supply of PPE.
Also requires that they let residents have access to critical safety information about the facility, and requiring the immediate public posting of a notice to stop placements. Now, what that means is if for whatever reason there's something going on, like an outbreak or a reason that they're not going to take any new residents, they have to immediately post that sign outside so the family members of people who are current residents are aware of what's happening inside. As someone who had a relative in a nursing home in the state for a long time, I was surprised that that wasn't already a requirement. This bill also requires that they have a written disaster plan for everything from the pandemic to, you know, earthquakes, floods, and fires. Again, something that I was surprised they didn't already have. So some efforts to make some changes in the works.
And does this going to require extra money or just a change in the rules?
Really just a change in the rules. I think there is some money going, though, to long-term care facilities that has more to do with the Medicaid match, and that came from the federal last stimulus program. So I don't think that there's a lot of state money required.
And this dramatic increase in the number of deaths due to COVID. So what do we do with that information besides, you know, I again realize how tragic it is.
And again, he says it's absolutely essential to have that accurate number of the total number of deaths as COVID continues, because we're not out of this yet, to really track the transmission rate. That's what he is saying this is really important for.
All right. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
The Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated, and our morning news editor, Miley Cady, live with us from the studio this morning with the story.
An elderly woman in Gig Harbor got some help with her yard work from the local fire department. I spoke with her neighbor, David Otto.
She's 91 years old, and, you know, we're kind of a tight neighborhood. And, you know, we all look after each other, but we're not here all the time. So I was running some errands, and I came home, and there was a big fire engine parked in the street.
He says she was cooking in her kitchen on Monday when she decided to go outside, get a little bit of fresh air, and mow the lawn. Normally, she doesn't mow her own lawn, but the person who usually does it couldn't come in that day, so she decided to just go for it. So she's out there and got a little bit distracted, as it's easy to do, and she forgot that she was cooking soup on her stove. So a fire started in her kitchen and filled her home with smoke. That triggered an alarm, and firefighters rushed to the rescue. They rescued her house, and while they were there, they also managed to rescue her lawn. Tina Curran is the spokesperson for Gig Harbor Fire.
They were waiting for the house itself to kind of clear of smoke and basically thought, gosh, you know, we can do more.
And they did.
Saw the firemen mowing the lawn, the big engine parked in the middle of the street, and the firemen are out there mowing the lawn and weed whacking.
David told me it was very refreshing to see the simple act of kindness, especially in the somewhat crazy times we're living in right now.
It's pretty stressful out there. Politics, the divisions in the country and everything. And it was just nice to see, you know, someone doing a nice thing. You know, they didn't have to mow the lawn. They could have just opened up the house and that was it. But, you know, it made me feel good.
So I asked Tina if the rest of us could score some free yard work if we burn a little soup in our kitchens.
Not quite. No. Every circumstance is a little bit different. And we, of course, always are trying to do our best to serve. But on certain circumstances, it lends itself that we can do a little bit extra.
If you want to see photos of the firefighters mowing her lawn, you can go to Gig Harbor Fire's Twitter account and see them. They're very
That's
adorable.
A wonderful story. And I know we're already a little bit late to break, but I do want to mention that today is Miley Katie's last day with us. And,
Miley.
I know.
I'm going to miss you. I'm going to listen. And after the pandemic cools down, I'd love to come visit.
Absolutely.
Good
Everybody
luck.
Should know what a talent Miley is, too. So it's incredibly hard to lose her. But we love her and we wish her the best. So, Miley, thanks for everything you did for us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Miley. 7:49 and now from the Gian Ursula Show. Weekdays 9 to noon on Cairo. Here is G. Scott. Dateline Walnut, California. This Sunday, Seahawks wide receiver DK Metcalf will compete in the Golden Games and Distance Open. What's that about?
This is somebody who's really fast. DK is really fast, and he's a physical specimen, and everybody's always talking about his speed and how fast he is, and oh my goodness. But I think DK Metcalf gonna learn a lesson on Sunday.
Really?
Because he's going against really, really fast guys that do this, well, professionally, if you will. You're talking about a bunch of little dudes that are 170, 165, dripping wet, about to run a 10.05, which, by the way, you need to run a 10.05 to be able to qualify for the Olympic trials. So there's going to be about 15 of those that's going to be doing that. I predict that DK, I'm not saying DK isn't fast. Mm-hmm. I predict he runs about a 10.5, maybe. And that's fast, right? I mean, that's really fast.
And 10.5 means what?
Well, I mean, in 10.5 seconds.
10.5 seconds.
Yes, I'm sorry.
And this is a 40-yard dash?
No, sir.
This is what?
This is 100. This is 100.
100 yards.
100 meter.
100 meters.
Yeah, 100 meters.
A little more than a yard.
Yeah. So
in 10.5 seconds.
10.5 seconds.
The length of, more than the length of a football field in 10.5 seconds.
110 yards, Brother Dave. 110 Whoa. Yards. Yes, sir. So
I've seen him run real fast across the football field before. I bet he could do it.
Okay. Let me put this in layman's terms for you and everybody that's listening
yes,
right now. Okay, check this out. Colleen, Dave,
yes.
How many times have you had someone say, Colleen, Dave, I bet I can do your job. All you guys do is talk. That's all you do.
Every
you know
day.
What? You know what, Colleen? Look out. Let me go ahead and do your daily dose of kindness. Let me go ahead and anchor the news. Let me do all of these things because you know what? All I got to do is just talk in a microphone. It's easy.
Right.
And anybody listening right now, whatever it is that your job is, it's interesting when people come up and say to you, I can do your job. Well, that's what this reminds me of. This is DK basically saying, oh, I'm fast. I could do what you guys do.
Yeah, but he's not just fast. He's paid to be fast, and he's been through the combine, right? Where they time him, we know what his time is, don't we? Has he done the 10.5 before?
Well, he didn't run track in college. I don't believe that he did, but I mean, he's always been really fast, and I don't know that it's not on record what he has run in the 100. It's on record what he has run in the 40. Here's one more reminder for you guys. What year is this? Is this an Olympic year for these? So these track stars right now are in the ultimate shape right now. I mean, they are in supreme shape.
Have you ever been in ultimate shape?
Me?
You just said that, and it made me think, like, have I ever reached that point where I'm like, yeah, this is what it's supposed to be like?
I think the best shape that I was ever in was my sophomore year in college when I played basketball. And yeah. That's when I felt good. I was really good shape. I was 7-8% body fat. I mean, I was in extreme shape. But
what about you, Dave?
I'll never see that again.
Senior in high school, I was bench pressing my weight, which was 110 pounds.
Ooh. I think about back in like my early 20s when I was so worried about like a little pooch on my stomach. And then I've had two babies, and I look back at those pictures where, you know, women, they like pose to the side every week or every month. And I'm like, you skinny little dummy. You wasted all that time worrying about this little pooch in your tummy, and you were looking good, girl. You know?
You're 100% right. You know what I blame that on, though?
What?
Society?
I blame it on society, but I blame it on being a kid. I remember when I was a kid and I'd be in a grocery store and I'd always see the tabloid pictures of like Oprah, and she'd be posing for something. Do you know Oprah never changed the way she looked? How in the world did they have Oprah looking the same the exact time? Like, oh, she looks really good. Oh, she looks really good. She looks the same in 1985 as she did in 2015 on the tabloids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a clean look.
Filters.
And $1 billion helps, too.
That's right. Gian Ursula starting at 9 on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G. It is 7:54. Seattle's Morning News. We have more legal claims now over the death of a 19-year-old girl at the CHOP, and a legal snag has appeared just before the signature-gathering phase for a Seattle charter amendment on homelessness. With the live update, here's Sky Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah.
Right, Dave. So this was the proposed charter amendment that was announced by Compassion Seattle, the campaign last month. That was basically a lot of our people who are advocates for homeless in the city, as well as some of the business groups who kind of came together and had this big proposal to essentially force the city to take certain actions on dealing with homelessness, with the goal to get everybody inside and hopefully clear out some of the parks and some of the dangerous situations that we've seen. It was seen as a pretty good compromise by a lot of people, but the signature gathering phase was supposed to start tomorrow, and now there's this legal snag because there's been a challenge filed over what else, of course, the ballot title, which these people filing the legal challenge in King County Superior Court say is misleading. Specifically, they point to a couple of things that are misleading. One, that it's being sold kind of as this holy grail that's going to solve homelessness and visible poverty. And that's not what it's going to do. According to Tiffany McCoy, who's one of the people behind this legal challenge and spoke to the Seattle Times, she says it's basically not going to do that, and that they have concerns about language that's vague regarding what they can and cannot do for clearing out those parks. The proposed charter amendment requires the city to spend 12% of its revenue every year on homelessness and mental health and various other things that some people dealing with homelessness might need. But it doesn't really put anything in place for exactly where that money comes from. You know, it doesn't bring any revenue in, essentially. So that's one of the complaints. And they don't think that's clear in the ballot title. And the fact that it requires 2,000 housing units is the word that's used in the ballot title, which is it can be, if you read, you know, the entire proposed charter amendment, it can be tiny house villages, it can be emergency shelter beds and all of that. So they say housing units doesn't accurately depict what that is. The people behind this proposed charter amendment say they're disappointed. It's basically a procedural challenge that's going to delay the signature collecting that was supposed to start tomorrow. So it could be, does it keep it from getting to the ballot? I don't know. I'm not seeing that right now.
People find this challenge. Do they have an alternative that would work to get the tents off the streets?
There's a few different people behind it. The one that spoke to the Seattle Times, she is with the street newspaper Real Change and also a member of the Project Homeless Advocacy Board. So they do they run special homelessness features on various media in the city, and they have for a couple of years now. So she's definitely an advocate, you know, for homeless. But no, they don't have the exact answer. They have different proposals, but it's always about protecting those who are dealing with homelessness first and building adequate housing units that are actually housing units, right? So you get people off the streets permanently and not shifting them around all the time.
Okay. I thought that's what the charter amendment was to do. But anyway,
moving on to the... And some of it is emergency beds. Beds.
Okay, yeah. So the CHOP issue now.
So this is a lot. There's so much legal action going on. And this is a 19-year-old man, Lorenzo Anderson, who was back in June, I believe it was June 20th of last year. He was shot multiple times, and we saw the video. I think we talked about it the following morning, Dave, where there was the medics would not come and get him because there was so much animosity going on up at the CHOP, and it was a danger to the medics. So the police had to give them the okay. That didn't happen. And 20 minutes, the kid bled out, and you finally saw that very powerful image where the pickup truck had of just civilians put him in the back, and they drove him to the hospital. He ended up dying. One lawsuit was filed last month by 19-year-old Lorenzo Anderson's mom, who spoke to Cairo 7 TV.
I should be celebrating my son. It's not easy to talk and try to be a pleasant person when you're in pain, you know?
Her lawsuit targets the city of Seattle.
There's no consequences behind what happened at the CHOP. How did they feel? Did they have kids? I just want to know, to just, somebody's hurt and you say, we're not going in, did it not bother nobody? Did everybody was able to sleep at night? I'm confused. I'm pissed. I'm never going to live the same for the rest of my life. Why do you not care?
Now, for mom, the bottom line is?
Accountability. What is accountability? You left the CHOP. You left your precinct. You didn't come in when you were supposed to. Nobody had a plan. Everybody knew about the CHOP being present. The outcome is death. What you going to do about it?
And she basically is saying in her federal lawsuit that the city of Seattle created a dangerous situation by allowing the CHOP to be there. Now, around the same time, there was a tort claim filed, with a precursor to a lawsuit filed by Lorenzo Anderson's father. This one goes after the city of Seattle, King County, and the state of Washington. Basically, everyone from the police to, you know, the National Guard who were negligent, they're not exactly sure who is going to end up being to blame here or which court they're going to file this lawsuit in. But this is three different claims, each for $1 billion with a B, dollars. This would be a very, very significant legal action. Now, that same lawyer just announced yesterday yet another claim. This is against filed on behalf of the estate of Lorenzo Anderson, the 19-year-old who was killed. And this goes after just a slew of people. Seattle Emergency Medical Services personnel, EMS, for not going in. Seattle Police Department for not allowing them to go in. The city of Seattle, the state, and I believe one other entity. And basically, they're saying they've had new information from calls that are going to come be released in discovery that they know are there that show that the EMS, I believe how they put it, left this teen to die in the CHOP zone. They would not go in out of fear. And so there's a vast number of lawsuits, and I don't know that we're done yet. There's another one filed by business groups, too, over the CHOP.
So what's the city's reply to this going to be? That there was, in fact, a real danger if they had gone in?
Very likely. I think that's how they've combated some of the other things that have come up. And we'll have to see. I mean, there's a duty. The kid bled out for 20 minutes. So,
but
we'll
it
have
is
to
policy.
See.
My understanding is it's always been policy that if there's a crime scene, for example, you don't let the medics go in if there's a chance that they will be harmed. And that's the police make that call.
Absolutely. And you remember, it was a couple of years ago, I think, there was a new policy put in place in specific hot zones. And I do believe that the Capitol Hill area was one, Pioneer Square, where they, because of the homeless folks and people who, you know, medics were being attacked, and it became a very dangerous situation. So fire department had made that policy very strict in certain areas. So it is possible that's a legal defense. We'll have to see.
So you'd have to sue the people who occupied the CHOP then.
Right. Well, no, because I think there's a vast number of different. It's not specifically just about the fact that EMS didn't go in. It's, again, like with the mom's lawsuit, right? You've got the fact that the city allowed this six block area to be taken over by these folks. Yeah. And therefore, it was, you know, just the wild, wild west. And that led to someone's death. So you have that. Again, the National Guard could have gotten involved and shut the CHOP down. It did not. So that's why you're going after the state of Washington in a couple of these. So I think they're casting a wide net and hoping something sticks.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.